Hi, welcome to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, and welcome to our Re-Air Summer. Summer is associated with transformation, personal development, and a sense of renewal before the new academic year begins. Our team at Stanford Psychology Podcast decided to take some time off, but don't worry, we are not going into radio silence. Instead, for every week until September 20th, we will air some of our favorite episodes around the topics related to personal development and self-improvement. We hope you will like it, and please don't hesitate to be in touch if you have any ideas for how our show can be improved in the new academic year. Thank you so much, and here's the episode.
Welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast. I'm Joseph, and today I spoke with Dr. Jay Van Bavel. Dr. Jay is an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at the New York University. His research examines how collective concerns, namely group identities, moral values, and political beliefs, shape the mind, brain, and behavior. In this episode, we chat about his new book titled The Power of Us, Harnessing Our Shared Identities to Improve Performance, Increase Cooperation, and Promote Social Harmony. Let's get to it. So thank you so much, Jay, for joining us for this podcast talk today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm so excited for today's conversation because we're going to talk about this new book you have with Dominic J. Packer. And the book is titled The Power of Us. So this is a fantastic book. And I will just give you the chance to start talking about what inspired you to write a book as an academic.
Yeah. I'll tell you the origin story of the book first. Basically, I was hanging out at Dominic's house in Lehigh. Well, he's a professor at Lehigh. He's in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And I was out there for the weekend hanging out with him and his family. And he was in a book club in his local community. And they had read a psychology book. And I asked, how was it? I haven't read it yet. And he said, it was good. But, you know, you could have written a book like this. Anybody could have written a book like this. It's just kind of a summary of a bunch of findings. And I said, there's no way I could ever write a book. I don't even know what I would write one on. And he said, of course you do. You write it on your research. You write it on, you know, groups and identity. And it was just a dumb conversation like that. A little light bulb went off my head. And I'm like, oh, maybe I never thought I could. I never really aspired to. And it got me thinking. And on my drive home that day, I kind of started thinking about what a book would look like. What would the chapters be and the sections? And as soon as I got home, I wrote down everything I had been thinking about and emailed him. And then we started on this path of like fleshing it out and going through that process, which I'm happy to share with anybody who wants to know. And then we got the book deal. And then unfortunately and tragically, the pandemic hit. And so, but we were stuck with a deadline that we had agreed to in a contract to write this book. And so we got stuck writing it in the middle of the pandemic, which I don't recommend to any human being alive. It's really, really too much. It's pretty stressful trying to do that deadline while you're like taking care of your kids at home and homeschooling and keeping your lab and teaching going. But once we did it, once we got writing, it was actually fun. In fact, it's a lot more fun to write a book like this than it often is to write our papers, which are very dry and academic, because you're trying to tell stories that get people excited about the things that you're finding in the lab and that other people are finding that you think are important and robust findings. And so there's a real fun process of thinking about what stories kind of line up with the data that would get, you know, someone who maybe is not a psychologist to understand what we normally are finding in our labs or talking about at our conferences. And so that part was fun. And then I will say, although it's pretty soul killing, once the book comes out, you go into this book promotion mode and it's just too much to do. And it's really exhausting, but there is a really fascinating thing. If anybody on this call is listening, thinking about writing a book, is that it opens you up to conversations with people you would never otherwise talk to. So that means scholars in other fields, people in organizations or government who are interested in trying to solve similar problems, and they haven't read often the science. And so your book is an entry point for them into all these things that we maybe take for granted and understand pretty well in our psychology conferences and communities. And so that ended up being a really fun and engaging and inspiring set of conversations. And so that's something that is, you know, an aspect of this I didn't predict and actually turns out to probably be the most rewarding part of it.
It worked out really well. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks.
I do share in some of these goals as someone who's a host of a podcast. We do also try to let lay people try to understand what's going on inside this like nebulous, vaguely academic rooms. I suppose let's dive right into the content of the book. You talk a lot about this idea of groups, of being in a group affecting your perception, affecting your behavior. So I'd just like to, first of all, set the foundation for this idea of a group. What do you mean by a group, a social group? And I know that in some parts in the book, you'd say that it's distinct from just simply a collection of people.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a story about it that we talk about in our book. It was based on a paper that I got from my original master's thesis advisor, Ken Dion. When I was a graduate student, he passed away at the end of my first year, and I got all his old articles and books from his wife. And I was going through the articles, and I found this really shocking paper from the 1970s. And it was this woman who had been in an airplane that had been hijacked and taken to the desert and by a group of hijackers who were holding it for political purposes. And it was a really terrifying story, but it turns out she was a social worker and she documented everything and then later published an academic paper on it. And she talked about, you know, the process of being a passenger on this hijacked plane, because normally when you get on an airplane, it's just a bunch of strangers. In fact, most of us don't even talk to the people next to us. We just like put on our headphones and watch the movie or listen to music or read a book that we brought. Hopefully, you know, if you're a book person. And what happened under this moment is it created a sense of solidarity. And at first, the sense of solidarity was actually divided. So at that moment, it depended on, at first, it was like basically what passport you had, because that determined your identity and whether these hijackers actually wanted to keep you as political prisoners. But over time, the groups bonded and provided a sense of solidarity and social support. And they created a sense of identity on this hijacked plane in the middle of the desert until they were ultimately rescued and saved. And so most of us have the potential for group identities in all kinds of situations that we don't realize. And the circumstances often create an identity for us. And so, you know, in the psychology studies that I have done over the years that were inspired by great work in the 70s and even the 50s was basically you can flip a coin, and I do this in the classroom when I teach, and put people into two groups, and within minutes they'll start identifying with their own group and they'll start allocating more resources towards their own group and liking their own group more. And so this happens really easy for us as humans. It often just takes something in the environment that we're in to trigger that sense of identity and foster a sense of cohesion.
I like this, the lab research you described. So one might think that in real life, we're involved in so many different kinds of groups and there's so many different levels of abstractions. Like in the airplane example, there's all of y'all in the same plane, maybe sharing this like calm tragedy, but then, you know, there's like college students in there, there's like little families in there, and, you know, there's like different groups at different levels. And so it's a curious thing how exactly academics study these sorts of groups because of all the complexity involved. And you describe these minimal group paradigms where you sort of strip out all of the different pieces of complexities involved and just like have an ad hoc group that's created, and you still see the effects operating on people's behavior. And I thought that was like really, really interesting and awesome. And also this idea that you flexibly activate different social identities that someone has or like different groups that they're involved in, and then you could see different effects on their behavior. I know, would you like to talk about that a little bit before we move into like the next chapter, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the big themes of our book. Originally, the working title I had for the book that I wanted to name it, but the publisher wouldn't let us, was Social Chameleons. And it's basically, in essence, this idea that we contain multitudes. We aren't fixed with any given identity, our gender identity, our age identity, our ethnic identity, religious, national identity, university identity. In fact, we contain all of these. And given situations draw out and activate different identities, and that changes how we interact with others and see the world. So right now, you and I are both talking to one another as fellow psychologists, but you could imagine a different situation where, you know, our universities were in competition and NYU was competing against Stanford on something, and then that might very much change the nature of our interactions. And this, of course, is me at work. If I have a student walk into my office in the middle of our conversation, then I'll probably take the role of professor. And I adopt a different tone and I take on a different set of responsibilities and ways of thinking about the interaction. As soon as I'm done here today, I'm going to go pick up my daughter from school. And then I shift into identity as a father. And that comes with a different set of assumptions and responsibilities. And I start completely forget about work. And I'm immediately asking her how her day is, starting to think about what I'm going to make her for dinner. And so we contain all of these, and situations elicit you know, stronger or weaker types of associations with different identities. And so I'm also Canadian. And when the Olympics come on, especially when Olympic hockey comes on, I activate that identity as a Canadian in a way that is very weird, right? Because I'm living in downtown New York and there's not a lot of the Canadians here. And a lot of people, my neighbors could care less about things like hockey. And so we contain all of these based on our experiences, our lived experiences and where we've been. And eventually we develop a sense of who we are based on this.
Yeah. Brilliant. Okay. So let's talk about chapter two. You titled it The Lens of Identity, which is about the specific ways that identity affects our experience of the world, which I think is a very simple yet really powerful idea. So I actually saved this quotation. This study reveals something important about human perception. We're often driven by our identities to interpret the world in a certain way. And that's just a quote from the book. And so you give all these examples about how when football players play a game that's recorded and something happens, and then you show the footage to different fans, depending on like what team the fan is supporting, they're going to interpret the video footage differently, which is just like mind-blowing, right? It's like, how is it that you're seeing the exact same objective reality, but then you all have these like varied interpretations about what's going on? So yeah, could you just explain this? Like, how is this possible? Like, what's going on in people's minds for something like this to happen?
Yeah, the reason we call this chapter The Lens of Identity is because I think of it very much like sunglasses. If I put on sunglasses, it tints the color that I see the world. And I think that that's a good metaphor for how identities work. And so the famous study was done in the 1950s, and it was based on a really rough college football game between Princeton and Dartmouth, who were playing, I believe, at Princeton at the time. And the teams got really violent, and Princeton had this amazing All-American quarterback who got badly injured and carted off the field. And then there was a bunch of other fouls and rough play. And so you might think that people who were there would kind of have a similar sense of what happened. But the day after the game, the two college newspapers wrote up a summary of what happened at the game. And the local Princeton college paper accused the Dartmouth players of being violent and aggressive. And meanwhile, at Dartmouth, the reporter there for the student paper basically said that Princeton was responsible. And so these two researchers at the two universities read these and were like, what's happening here? How could everybody be seeing the same thing and coming to such different conclusions? And so they ran a study where they literally showed people the tape of the game and asked them how many fouls each team committed. And Dartmouth and Princeton students came to very different conclusions, even when they were just forced to watch the tape, you know, without all the distractions of people there and conversations afterwards. And so what they concluded is that people are, you know, filtering essentially what they were seeing, and it was changing their interpretations pretty dramatically. And, you know, any sports fan, once you hear about this is why everybody hates the refs and umpires at sporting events. It's because they always seem biased against us, because when something's ambiguous, we interpret it through the lens of what we want to see, which is something aligned with our favorite team. But the same thing plays out in all kinds of domains. So other examples we used were, for example, like police videos. When you see ambiguous videos showing conflict between a police officer and a suspect, and it's hard to see who's at fault, people start filtering it through the lens of their identities. And people who identify with the police draw very different conclusions about who's at fault than people who do not identify with the police. And there's research, Yale Grinnell, who is a former PhD student here at NYU, looked at eye trackings. So you could see people's eye movements and see that they were different depending on who you identified with. And so we're filtering the world through our identities. And part of how it's doing is what it's doing is it's changing where we're looking in interactions. It's changing what we're watching on the field. It might be changing when we open the newspaper in the morning. We're looking to different headlines or lingering more, looking more to the stories of different things that are appealing to us. And a part of that is determined, it seems, by the different identities that people have, especially really strongly held identities.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you. So I'd just like to do a quick digression, and I have a question. I'm curious about your position on this. So I know that at least in cognitive science, much ink has been spilled of this idea of cognition affecting perception, sort of top-down effects in perception. And what this means is just that how you think about the world affecting, I guess, sensory information you're receiving or like your perception versus affecting what you're interpreting. I guess the debate is over whether people actually perceive the same objective reality or whether everyone is just like experiencing their own reality. And in a sense, we don't have a shared reality to experience. because I feel like reading some of the chapters here, it seems that you are like very careful with your language to not maybe imply that people are perceiving objectively different realities, but also it's not necessarily clear based on some of the examples you're giving. Do you have a position on this?
First of all, it's a great question. That's a big debate in philosophy and cognitive science. I've been in that debate. I've written several papers on it. So we use the term perception in our book pretty broadly because a lot of the studies are not very carefully controlled measures of perception, and they can be explained by things like selective attention and memory. And so the debate about the real debate, I think, about like, is perception penetrable by cognition is often at the point of down to very low level perception, you know, like in brain terms, like V1, V2, V3. And so I don't know if none of these studies really answer that deep question, but I would say if you define perception a bit more broadly, other than just like sensory processing, I'm pretty convinced that we selectively attend to things in ways that alter our interpretation of reality. And that interpretation means that you and I may or may not share a reality. If we're at the game and we have different perceptions of whether a foul is committed, it might be because I was looking at a different player than you at the time. And so we're seeing different things. Whether that's cognition penetrating and shaping like the way that neurons in V1 respond to like colors and edges on the field is harder to say. But I do think at minimum, it suggests that we might be encoding different information in part because we're looking at the same thing differently, or at least looking differently in the same visual field at different parts of it. And that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that has the same consequence. In fact, probably a more profound consequence of shaping how we interpret it. So that's why sometimes it can be hard to get people on the same wavelength. That's why, actually, I talked about policing. That's one of the reasons how a lot of police forces require police to wear cameras. And so at least in a court of law, you know, jurors can see exactly what was in their visual field. And so that is a better way of doing it. But still, if people are watching a video and it's ambiguous, then they might be looking at different parts of the video. And so you can still get some filtering going on. And I keep using the word ambiguous because these tend to, the way identity works, I think, is it's shaping our interpretation of things that are ambiguous. If things are super clear, and you've seen some of these videos that go really viral of police brutality, it's when you watch it, it's obvious to almost any human who watches it what's happening. Then I don't think identity is doing as much work. It's like you're forced to grapple with the brutality of what you're seeing. It's more when it's ambiguous and there's a scuffle or something like that, or people are kind of like testifying and you're forced to like interpret who might be right. That's, I think, where things like identity seems to be playing a bigger role.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think we're going to talk about bias because it's a prominent theme that comes out in this book. Yeah, okay. So let's see. Chapter three, you talk about this phenomenon called groupthink. And there's this notion that people could arrive at irrational decisions out of a desire for social conformity when they identify with certain groups. And you go through examples of like these doomsday cults where they prophesy the end of the world and then that happens and then they still retain their beliefs and just like change their justification, or different corporate cults, etc. So yeah, this is an interesting phenomenon, how exactly identifying with a group and having a shared reality just like warps your beliefs, even in the face of like evidence that doesn't match. Could you go over this? Like, how does this happen?
Yeah. I mean, this is probably my favorite chapter of the book. So we open with the story from one of my favorite studies of all time, which was done by Leon Festinger. He was reading the newspaper one day, and he's one of the most famous social psychologists in history. He's the person who came up with cognitive dissonance theory. And he was reading the newspaper and he saw this ad, I think it was an ad or an article, about this woman who was basically predicting a cataclysmic flood that was going to kill many, many people in the Midwest. And it was basically calling people to, you know, join the cause of like trying to like deal with this. And so he realized this was going to be a great way to study cognitive dissonance, because he figured she was kind of predicting this, aliens were going to, you know, we're telling her there was going to be this cataclysmic flood. They were going to come down in an alien spaceship and save true believers. And he was a skeptic. And so he figured, okay, this is total bullshit. But it's a great way to study cult psychology and look at cognitive dissonance. He's like, they're predicting a catastrophe and the alien ship to come at a specific time. I can be in the room with them when the clock hits midnight on that day and see how they react. Because he figured these true believers, these cult members, called the seekers, would want to cling to their belief because they cared so much about it. They had devoted, like, you know, they're often their entire lives. They had lost friends and you know, their jobs by joining this cult. But the reality that they were predicting wasn't going to happen. And so he was going to be literally in the room where they had to face a fact check of enormous magnitude for them that challenged their entire belief system. And so he figured that would be a moment of maximal cognitive dissonance where they're really uncomfortable and they're forced to either like leave the cult and accept the truth, or are they going to double down and stick in the cult? And most of us would expect, I think, if we were to like write down our prediction before we joined one of these things, it's like, yeah, if this doesn't happen, I'll accept reality and I'll leave. And what he found was the exact opposite. He's like, was in the room and the clock struck midnight and everybody's quiet and staring at each other and the alien ship didn't come. And then someone realizes, oh, there's a clock in another room that's like showing 11:55. That must be the one that's right. And so they already rationalized the first clock striking midnight, no one coming, by thinking, oh, though that clock can't possibly be right, because otherwise the aliens would be here. They go in another room, watch the clock. It strikes midnight. No one comes. And they're sitting in this room all night long and in silence, and someone breaks down in tears, and they're facing the reality that the cult was wrong and that their prophecy failed. And then the leader, I forget what her name is, Marion Keach, I think was her name. And she all of a sudden says, I'm getting a message from the aliens. Our beliefs were so strong that we saved the world. That's why the aliens didn't come. And so they started going out the next day and proselytizing, which they hadn't even really done before. And that was very consistent with cognitive dissonance, that they were so uncomfortable with the reality that the ship didn't come. The moment they had a way to rationalize the fact that it came, they clung to it and they went even further to try to convince other people to join the cult. And the two factors he concluded were the single biggest predictors of whether or not you clung to this belief was the strength of your belief. So if you're a real true believer in something, you're going to cling to it a lot longer. But the other most important one is about social psychology. And I think this one's a much more profound and surprising finding, which is he reasoned that and concluded from spending, you know, many, many weeks with this cult and his research team embedded in them as if they were cult members, that it's the social support that sustains beliefs. So if any one of us were true believers and we encountered a contradiction of our belief system, that we might be able to give it up. But the moment that we have everybody else around us trying to rationalize and support and find evidence in favor of the belief system, and they still believe, then it seems like that must be true. And it's easier for us to cling to it. And so if you want to understand how false beliefs get sustained, it's because the community reinforces and bolsters them. And so we tracked this in corporations like Enron. There's a paper analyzing how Enron imploded. That was one of the biggest corporate disasters in history. They had a very cult-like psychology of leaders expecting people to follow and go along and believe stuff that was quite insane at the time. Now, contradict that with other types of identities, right? So we're having this conversation as scientists. Part of the norms of science is that you're going to get someone, if you write something that's wrong, someone's going to not replicate it, or they're going to challenge it, or they're going to write an article, or now they write a blog post or write a thread critiquing you on academic Twitter. Because we have a strong culture of skepticism and collective decision-making. And if anything, in the last 10 years, the single thing we've learned is that a lot of things we believed on, the moment they came under serious scrutiny, we've been forced to abandon them. And so this is one of the things, is that the norms of groups don't have to be cult-like. They can actually be centered on accuracy and reward people who poke holes in bad ideas and disprove them. But when they're not, you get something like the Seekers cult or Enron. And so it's really important to think of a group that you have a culture and institutions and structures and norms that reinforce systems and ways of deciding what's accurate and then discarding bad ideas. Because otherwise, you end up with, you know, belief systems that are cult-like and where you cling to bad ideas for a long time.
So quick point, I just thought we should mention this because it's relevant to the culture wars. So people claim that in academia, we have this liberal bias, right? And so you ran this interesting study. I'm not sure whether you ran it or you just described the study, but you looked at whether this affects the quality of the findings we have. And this was an interesting point because it goes over what are the factors that could sort of prevent these biases from like seeping into the findings that we have. And I think that this was like a really interesting study that you did. Do you want to describe it?
So one of the critiques of psychology, especially social psychology, is that it's too left-leaning. There's too many Democrats a disproportionate number of Democrats. And there's no question about that in most academic fields, especially the social sciences and humanities, even more so. And so a lot of people have said that's like a real perfect context for groupthink to happen, where you have a bunch of people who believe the same thing. you know, if you submit a paper and I'm an editor, I might be more likely to accept it if it aligns with my political beliefs, is the argument. And therefore, a lot of bad work will get into the field. And so that has been one of the criticisms. And people have argued that's why some, you know, many effects recently in psychology and social psychology haven't replicated. And there's a New York Times article making that claim. And so we decided, well, let's actually run the study on that claim. We know there's a lot of Democrats, but we also know that science has norms and institutions that kind of mitigate against groupthink in a way that a lot of organizations and cults do not have those institutions in place and norms. And so we thought that might mitigate against some of these identity-based concerns. We also thought that people, you know, might have an identity that's political, but they have other identities. We contain multitudes, right? So that means you also have an identity as a scientist, and it means getting status in the scientific community, getting publications, getting grants, depends on doing high-quality research based on whatever the standards are at the time and having that research hold up over time. And so we thought that that would mean that there'd be a lot less likely to be shoddy findings in the field. And so we did an analysis of nearly 200 studies that have been replicated to look at what predicts failures of replication. And we had a bunch of coders, including liberal and conservative coders and moderates. And we had them all independently code a bunch of almost 200 papers when they read the abstract and tried to decide, is this liberal leaning or conservative leaning? And then we looked, you know, 10 years later to see if those findings were more or less likely to replicate. We also went into the studies and looked, did they have good sample size? Did they have good, strong effects? And what we found is there was really no evidence for liberal bias. In other words, findings that had more liberal conclusions were no more or less likely to replicate than findings that had more conservative conclusions. And in fact, what we found predicts whether or not a finding replicates is things like, is it a well-run study? Does it have a big sample? Is it a strong effect? So really foundational things that are core to like the scientific publication process seem to be the best predictors of, you know, replication success later. It's not really, there was very little, if really nothing we found that was related to liberal leaning conclusions. And so I think that that reinforced, and when we started that study, I will be honest with you, I went into my lab and I talked to my graduate students. We had a postdoc working on it as well. And I said, no matter what we find, someone is going to hate us. because if we find that liberal bias exists, we're going to have a lot of liberals in the field mad at us. If we find conservative bias, then the people who are critical of liberals, those people are going to be really mad at us. Maybe we'll get, Republican politicians mad at us. And if we find nothing, all these people who are making these claims might be mad at us or irritated or try to debunk us. So we pre-registered everything, did the most rigorous possible thing. Like I said, we recruited liberal and conservative coders. They came to the same conclusions. And so it was one of those things where after we did it, the results were really clear and robust. We also found another person as we started the study who was doing the exact same study, and he had a different prediction than us. He really thought expected to find liberal bias, Jared Crawford, and he was in New Jersey. And we got in touch with, as we got people to review our paper, they told Jared's doing something similar. We teamed up with him, tried to align our methods, and he ran his own study and he came to the same conclusions as us. So that was, so that's called a adversarial collaboration. So we really did all the institutional practices that are key to finding robust results. Pre-registration, we had open data, we had a replication, we had an adversarial collaborator, and we came to this, and we had coders who were liberal and conservative, and we came to this robust finding. And so that, to me, is exactly how you want to run science. You want to do it with robust methods and let the chips fall where they may in terms of what you find. And so, it helped update my beliefs in terms of the robustness of science. I'm not saying that the actual scientists aren't left-leaning, but I'm saying our data show that that doesn't seem to mean that the findings are any weaker than if the findings had been more conservative.
Perfect. And did you get any angry tweets? Actually, I'm curious.
Yeah, we got some people. We had a couple of people, I won't say names, but man, they had many angry tweets. There are many people who trolled us. There were several blogs written criticizing our paper. We got some angry emails. So I was right about that someone would be mad. And so I had to do a debate on it at a conference, debate against somebody who wouldn't agree with it. We got some angry reviews. I could tell you, we got with this paper some of the most insane reviews I've ever seen. At one journal, multiple reviewers liked it, but it got rejected based on a reviewer who wouldn't even show us their review. They sent it to the editor. We couldn't even see it. And I have to say, I've seen about 1,000 reviews in my day. I'm an editor. I've published over 100 papers. I haven't seen that once in my life. And so there are people who are angry about this finding and did not like it and tried from what my appearance tried to suppress it. But, you know, eventually there's multiple journals. Got it a great journal. People can read it now. They can analyze our data. We made our data public. And so that's the other thing about science. It's really hard to suppress something because if someone tries to block it somewhere else, there's other journals and they will usually uphold higher quality standards.
Yeah, that's good to hear. And yeah, I feel like if you're an academic who does work in these domains, moral, political stuff, you just probably want to have a thick skin, or it's just going to be really tough, I feel like.
If you wade into these types of questions, like you use the term culture wars, right? This is the equivalent of culture wars coming into science. Mm. And so if you're going to weigh in and do research on this stuff, you have to be prepared to have a thick skin. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's not. I don't think that's good. But on the other hand, I respect that some of these people are really smart scientists, very well established, have published many, many papers, and they really scrutinized it. And I respect their right to do that. And I'm glad that we have a community that does that, even though I ended up in the, we ended up by student Diego, who's, you know, he's a grad student on this. He's a first author. So I really also just want to say, like, I respect him for having a thick skin at an early career stage. It's easier for me to say I have tenure, but when it's junior career people, early career people who are younger and they wade into this, it took a lot of courage for him to do that, I think more so than I.
Okay, great. I know I said I wanted to go over like everything in the book, but I'm realizing that's like physically impossible. So I'll just tell the listeners, like, there's lots and lots of good content in chapter 4 and 5, which we're not going to go over, on political partisanship and brain differences between people and how that affects their partisanship, or like how your political identity might affect what sorts of headlines you focus on. You talk about lots of brilliant research by professors like Molly Crockett, who I feel like it's quite familiar to other academics, on like, you know, what sorts of words trigger people and how people make use of that to spread disinformation, for example, or yeah, that and much more. So I'll just like skip over for now to like the sections on overcoming bias, just because I think that's like particularly important and relevant, at least to me. So you began by going over this like quote or this question that this attorney general, I suppose the guy who was being confirmed for attorney general, actually, I don't think it happened. Merrick Garland was asked by a congressperson, which was, you know, what does it mean when someone has implicit bias? Does that mean they're racist or not? And it was a controversial, it's still a controversial thing. And I feel like you do such a good job sort of going over like what implicit bias measures detect, what they are, and, you know, including some brain imaging work on like what actually it should mean, and at least your interpretation of it and how it shows up in our institutions. So I don't know whether you'd like to really quickly go over, I guess, your understanding of what does it mean to have implicit bias and like how could we overcome it, if at all?
Yeah, so implicit bias is probably, you know, in my lifetime has been the most prominent topic that has exploded outside of psychology. Mm-hmm. It was part of Merrick Garland's hearings for attorney general. He did get, I think, nominated. He is attorney general. He was originally nominated by Barack Obama to be Supreme Court justice, and that was blocked by Republicans. They wouldn't give him a hearing. But anyways, and obviously it's really important in policing to understand what types of bias are underlying police decisions. That's one of the topics of our generation, to understand this and figure out solutions around this to create a more just society. So implicit bias has been around for a long time, since, you know, the 1990s, when I was starting as a graduate student in early 2000. It was thought of something that we have these associations based on our culture and exposure to the news and the media and people around us, our family, our friends, our community. And to some extent, most of us develop these associations. And it depends on what culture you're in. And so in the United States, it is one of the big studies found people have stronger associations with black and bad than white and good. They also have strong associations with elderly and bad and young and good. Even elderly people show pro-youth bias. And all you got to do is walk by a magazine stand to see the images. There's very few elderly people shown in positive ways. It's all youth and beauty. There's also one of the other strongest forms of bias in implicit bias literature is between career. So men are associated with kind of career pursuits, and women are associated with family roles, gender roles. And so there's all kinds of bias. Many of us have studied it. I started studying it about 20 years ago. First thing I studied when I started grad school is to understand implicit bias. And so I think there's no question in my mind whatsoever that people harbor these associations. They're widely shared, but they vary. So they vary depending on the region you're from. They vary depending on the experiences you have when you grow up. They vary depending on the society you're in and the hierarchies that exist within those societies and how people are and groups are portrayed in media. There's lots of data now backing it up. The problem with implicit bias, and this is where I think it goes wrong, is people can go online and do this test. And I give it to my own undergraduate students. And then they get feedback about what their score is. But what I often tell them is the test itself is not very reliable. It's not as reliable as, say, other like the big five personality tests where you can, you know, measure your extroversion now and your extroversion tomorrow. And they're very highly correlated. With these implicit measures, there's a lot more measurement error. And there's a lot lower correlation between what you score today and what you score tomorrow. And so the best way to study this, I think, implicit bias is at the aggregate, to look with large samples at this at big scale. And then I think that, so that's one way to study it. And there's been a challenge. That's why there's been lots of criticism of implicit bias, is the measures have really been unreliable for a long time. And in my opinion, haven't improved as much as I would like. But I think there's unequivocal evidence that there are these associations and that they are biased. And so then the question is, how do they leak into our everyday behavior? And this is something that is still being studied. It's not well understood, I don't think, at this point in a compelling way. But, you know, it potentially comes out in your subtle behaviors, you know, like, and I'll say one of the more damning studies, it doesn't actually look at implicit bias per se, but my bet is this is a place where implicit bias happens, is when people send in resumes. There's research showing that when people send in resumes, identical resume, identical credentials, they just change the name to be African-American sounding or Caucasian sounding, so black or white sounding name. And people are 50% more likely to, companies are 50% more likely to call back somebody with identical resume with a white sounding name than a black sounding name. And that might be explicit racism. I would not be surprised if some of it is. But my guess is some of it is implicit bias. And because I think here's why. When people review resumes in the real world, and I've seen this, they might get a batch of 100 resumes and they've got like an hour to go through it. So they're flipping through it really quick. They're not actually doing a deep dive in things. They're trying to triage and find out, you know, what are the top five people that I should call back for interviews. And so they're using heuristics, and things like race in this country are associated with, as we said, because of the media and exposure to things, are associated with all kinds of things, including class-based information is one of them. And so people, I think, are using that to filter all kinds of information that they're perceiving in the world, especially ambiguous information, and that's driving their decisions. And so then the next part of implicit bias is, how do you get rid of it? Okay. So if most of us have it to some degree, one of the most compelling studies to me on this, so my research found that if you put people, it's my dissertation research, if you put people in a shared group, mixed race group, and you flip a coin and create minimal groups, but each group is mixed in race, people suddenly show positive associations to their in-group, no matter what their race is. And so that seems like the moment you draw a circle of an identity that includes a diverse group of people, you feel positive towards those people and negative towards whatever the other group is. And so it seems to be pretty flexible based on what our identity is. But there was a really powerful intervention study led by Calvin Lai. And what he found is that these identity-based interventions turn out to be one of the strongest interventions of any that have been tried in this space. But pretty much all interventions that work are gone after 24 hours. And so what that means is, even if you were able to change people's thinking about something in the moment, they then go back and turn on the news or open the paper or revert to their old way of thinking. And so that's why I think you need real structural change if you're going to address these. You need people to think about themselves more inclusively and also create decision-making procedures, for example, hiring, that maybe remove people's name from it. And that would be one way that, from that resume study alone, you'd immediately reduce a huge amount of discrimination. And so there are ways to do that. Of course, there's ways that also goes wrong. I can have a whole discussion about like artificial intelligence and ways that that's been used in hiring. Sometimes some studies have found it can reduce bias. Other studies have found it can increase bias because the machine learning algorithms start selecting on things like where you live, and your neighborhood might be associated with low work performance, but it's really just because you're from a poor neighborhood. And in this country, which is racially segregated and where there's massive economic and health disparities, that you're basically just reproducing racism in another form. And so we have to be very careful about what systems we create too. It's not an easy solution. It requires a lot of thought and people to be very wise about these other variables that are also heuristics that can be used to foster discrimination.
Yeah, thank you for that. That was really wonderful. So there's still a lots and lots more to cover, which I think I'm just going to really quickly mention. And I don't think we're going to go into the details, but I'd just like to say, I mean, just for the record, that like there's just lots and lots of powerful ideas you go over in the following chapters about the chapter on finding solidarity, where you talk about social identities that are defined or fostered by a sense of shared adversity. So all these social movements like Black Lives Matter or like movements for climate change or social change, etc. And so you go over like, what do we think makes a successful movement? Like what sorts of dilemmas do activists face where they're trying to be socially, you know, have popular support while at the same time apply pressure to people in power? We talk about dissent, how dissenters aren't actually well regarded, even though they're useful for a social group. So, I mean, there's all these things that I don't even think we're going to have time to go over because you only have 7 minutes. I suppose, do you want to summarize like what you want people to get out from this book, if you'd like?
If you find this interesting, please do go to our website, powerofus.online, and you can read the reviews and the summaries of each chapter that Joseph did a good job of summarizing. I would say the big thing that we think is that identity matters for a lot of human behavior. Not all of it. In fact, not even a majority of it. You know, in our book, we say it might matter for 5% of human behavior, but that 5% matters to people. Their identities matter to them. There's an important element of reducing discrimination and fostering dignity in all kinds of people, creating inclusive environments. And that should manifest in the way that we create norms in groups, the way that our leaders behave, and the way that we think. In our last chapter, we really talk about the future of identity. We talk about the role of inequality. When you have massive inequality in organizations, people start to disidentify with the organization and distrust leadership. We talk about the role in climate change, that in the United States, which is one of the biggest carbon emitters in the world, we're hugely divided based on our partisan affiliation in terms of our beliefs about what's causing climate change and how to fix it. And then the other one is democracy. If we want to have healthy democracies, identity is a fundamental issue there. But what are the democratic norms that we're going to foster and sustain? And so I think that for all the big issues going forward, identity is going to need to be part of the conversation. And that I want to be part of that conversation too. And I want you to. I think like the reason we wrote the book is to get this in the hands and these ideas in the hands of the next generation of people in all kinds of walks of life. So it could infuse their thinking and give them the tools to be better about selecting their own identities, what groups they care about. And then if they're in a group, how they create a healthy group, how they create groups that allow for dissent and other voices to be heard, how they take the role of leader, whether they're leading, you know, their daughter's soccer team or whether they end up running a team or a company at work. We want them to understand how to harness this in ways that are going to foster a healthier society that allows everybody to flourish.
Okay, so I just give you a chance to you've already given lots of really useful advice. As a young academic personally entering psychology, I'm actually curious about any particular specific advice you have, including like how you, for example, know an idea is worth pursuing or like decide on research ideas or questions.
Yeah, so I would say there's a few principles we use in my lab. One is that the idea ideally is going to make a theoretical impact, that you're kind of advancing our understanding of human psychology. And then I like it also have a practical impact. And in our lab, that's easy. It should be an issue we care about. And so that means like recently we've been studying COVID and vaccinations and social behavior. Well, we have a giant project right now in over 70 countries looking at climate change interventions. I've already talked to you, my work originally in graduate school was about reducing bias and discrimination. And so all of those we view through the lens of identity and norms and leadership, but we can tackle all these. We also do research on disinformation and conspiracy theories. And so my students are really, when they do something they care about that's happening in the real world, they're intrinsically motivated to study it. They're reading about it all the time. They're thinking about it. It becomes so easy to do that if it's a topic that might be theoretically interesting, but you don't care about. And so really having those two things not only means you're going to care about it more, you're going to be more passionate about it, you're going to have more meaning when you wake up every morning and come to your job, but also that other people will care for it. The more that I and my students have leaned into studying the things we care about, the more impact our work has had, the more people want to hear about it, the more that we get emailed in conversations, invited to talk to people outside of our field. And so that's, I think, something that is a really powerful lesson. And then the other lesson I would say is kind of aim for the moon. What you want when you start out a new project, I often think of what the potential ceiling is if it works out really well. I don't want to start a project that has a very low ceiling. It's often not worth it to me. And as anybody knows who does research, your data never quite comes out as nice as you want. Usually takes many more studies and many more years than you would hope. And so you want to aim really high. And then if you shoot for the moon, at least if you miss it, you land among the stars. Like you end up with something good that's likely to be useful and impactful in some lesson. You don't want to limit your potential at the outset and narrow it too early.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Those are really, really good tips. Appreciate it. Okay. So I think we have gotten to the very end. I'm surprised we were really good with time, but yeah, it's like 11:59 a.m. on the dot Pacific. So Thank you so, so much, Professor J. Professor J, do people call you that?
Okay, my students actually, my students call me Dr. J.
Dr. J. Okay.
That kind of rolls off the tongue a little more than Professor J.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. J, for sharing your insights about your wonderful book. I encourage our listeners to check this book out. It's fantastic. And as he said, check out his the website, thepowerofus.com, you say?
Powerofus.online, yeah.
Dot online, right. And I think you also have a really active Twitter page that you could tell people to follow.
Follow me on Twitter at jay.vanbavel. I probably spend too much time on Twitter. Almost an unhealthy degree of time.
Thank you so much for listening. We would love to hear what you think of this episode or our podcast in general. If you have any other suggestions for future guests or topics of the podcast, you can click on a link on the survey attached on the show notes or reach us at stanfordpsychpodcast@gmail.com. You can also connect to us on Twitter at @StanfordSciPod. And finally, if you enjoyed the podcast, please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere.